Ramon Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. The Green New Deal is a congressional resolution that could reshape the U.S. economy by tying it to the fight against climate change. We'll hear how it stacks up to what California is already doing. Plus, I rode a bike around downtown L.A. to get a feel for how safe it is.
Are you okay?
Oh, sorry.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I got it.
How L.A. is trying to make cars, bikes, and people coexist without crashing. Ahead on Take Two.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering 3 psychology master's degrees this April. Priority deadline to apply for summer term scholarship is February 15th at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Happy Thursday to you. Coming up, potholes.
When there's cracks or holes in the street and it rains, water gets in and disturbs the base. And now the riding surface can start to collapse a little bit.
Yeah, really annoying. We speak with the assistant director of LA's Bureau of Street Services to find out why potholes get so much worse in the rain and what the city plans to do about it. First, though, the Green New Deal. It's been the focus of a lot of buzz today. It's a policy package before Congress that would reshape the country's energy landscape. Now, since the release of the revised plan this morning, enthusiasm has been high, even though the chances of widespread political support are low. Plan co-sponsor Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez shared details with Morning Edition Steve Inkeep.
Even the solutions that we have considered big and bold are nowhere near the scale of the actual problem that climate change presents to us, to our country, and to the world.
That's Steve Inskeep. Among the proposals, getting 100% of the country's power from clean energy sources in the next 10 years. That's far more ambitious than California's plan to reach that goal by 2045. So how does this proposal stack up to what California is doing already? Let's ask Sean Hecht. He's the co-executive of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA. Sean, welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
All right, Sean, I should start by saying that this is a non-binding resolution. That means if it passes, it won't create any new programs. But right now, what's your reaction to this plan?
It's a very exciting and ambitious vision. I think even though it doesn't have anything concrete in it yet in terms of bill text, the vision that it provides, I think, provides a really good blueprint for how we should think about climate change in a comprehensive way in this country.
So a good blueprint, and it is very ambitious, but as we've mentioned, it has no real teeth. Funding is not clear. I'm wondering, Sean, is its value more tied into how it keeps the conversations on combating climate change top of mind?
I think that that's right. I think at this point, all we see is the vision. I anticipate that there will be actual concrete legislative proposals that come out of it. And so when we see those, we'll begin to understand what the actual policies are that might be implemented as a result of it. But I do think that it changes the conversation, and in particular, the way that it links climate change to economic development and to a better life for everyone in the country, I think is something that we haven't seen in the conversation in Washington in recent years.
Now, we'll get to the California angle in just a second. But, Sean, I got to ask, the Paris Climate Accord has no mechanisms to hold nations accountable to anything. And the Green New Deal is kind of sort of the same. So how's anything ever really going to change?
Well, again, this is just a resolution from Congress, and so it's the first step. One would assume that the folks who are putting this together have plans to introduce more concrete resolutions that would enable the federal government to move forward with more specific policies and goals and targets and funding. I think one big difference between this and the Paris Agreement is that the expectation is that this will be followed up by firm commitments in the form of proposed legislation rather than the end result of it being a set of voluntary commitments without any particular policies behind them.
We're talking to Sean Hecht, co-executive at the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA. All right, so let's look at California. We've had a cap and trade program for several years. Let's talk about how it lines up with this Green New Deal. One aspect of the state's goal is reaching 100% clean power by 2045. What else in this framework lines up with California's goals?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that line up with the goals of California. It's not only the energy supply and the role of renewable energy in that, but it's also a new vision of our transportation system to have zero emission vehicles over time. And there's also some of other types of infrastructure, including building for adaptation and resilience and understanding the impacts of climate change. All of that is work that we have been doing in California with our various programs. Cap and trade is just one of the many programs we have in California to address greenhouse gas emissions. And although it's gotten the most attention, it's certainly not the only one. And so I see a lot of alignment between the policies that California has already enacted and what we might see under the Green New Deal.
In some ways, are we ahead of the Green New Deal?
I would say very much okay. So, in the sense that California has very concrete policies that we've been implementing for 10 years and more now, whereas at the federal level, the Green New Deal is at this point just a vision. I think there's a lot of potential in the Green New Deal idea. Investment in new technology and in linking that on a national basis to lifting up local economies in a lot of areas. And you know, we are still working on all that, of course, in California. But as a matter of policy, we're far ahead in California.
What else would it need, though, Sean, the Green New Deal to help enforce some of its desired goals?
Well, I think clearly funding is part of what's necessary. We need the federal government to be investing in some of these policies the same way that it's invested in other technology, the technology that eventually became the internet, for example. We've seen federal investments in energy research and technology development over many decades, and I think focusing those in renewable energy will be really important. We also ultimately will need more direct policies to limit carbon emissions, and we'll also need things that link these new policies to the economic futures of Americans, people who live near oil refineries, people who live near coal mines and are affected by those economies will want to see that this lifts them up instead of economic growth being perceived as at odds with environmental, with protecting.
But Sean, considering that, as we mentioned, the funding isn't quite clear, if this thing eventually gets sold to everyone as a thing that will eventually pay for itself, I mean, is that something that is realistic as a way to sell this to people?
So I don't know. I think it really remains to be seen. I don't think seeing it as paying for itself is exactly the right way to look at it. We have to understand this as a long-term investment in order both to change and transform our energy economy. We're going to have to do that sooner or later anyway. We'll have to get off of fossil fuels within a relatively short amount of time. And so we will be paying the costs of that transition. And this is a vision that will enable us also to really reap a lot of benefits from that transition. It is possible that there will be mechanisms to get this paid. There will be economic growth and development that comes with it. I don't think that's the key piece of it. I see it as investment in the future more than anything else.
Well, since you bring up fossil fuels, the industry itself, do you expect to see the same people coming out against this proposal?
Absolutely. I mean, these types of proposals are always threatening to the oil industry, to the coal industry, to other fossil fuel interests, and it would not be surprising to see that same opposition. I think that things have changed somewhat over the last few years so that those industries are increasingly becoming isolated as we see other large and small industries coming out more in favor of addressing climate change because of the benefits that it will bring and because of the deep, deep costs it will take to adapt. And the inevitability of changing our energy supply. But of course, the oil and coal and other fossil fuel interests will be fighting this.
All right, Sean, now the politics without getting too political. The proposal has been a bit controversial, even among Democrats. And according to the New York Times, Nancy Pelosi has no plan to bring it to the floor for a vote. Why do you think there's some hesitation to approach this plan?
Well, it's an extraordinarily comprehensive vision, and it's a vision that directly links what you could think of as a jobs and economic program to the environmental program. And so, in a way, it's a very, very heavy lift in terms of the scope of what Congress I can imagine that there will be quite a bit of political opposition, certainly in the Republican Party, where this type of approach has not been popular. I don't have a sense of where this is going and what the relative merits of bringing this forward piece by piece or in a big vision might be. I do think we can expect that once we see the vision being implemented, the proposals will be in chunks. There's not going to be one bill that is the Green New Deal eventually. We'll see pieces of this in very different forms.
Is there a role California could play in making the Green New Deal a reality?
I think absolutely so. We have a lot we've done a lot here in the state, as I mentioned, and I think that the federal government and other states can take lessons from California, both from our successes and the areas where we haven't achieved as much. I think our leaders in California will have a lot to bring to the conversation based on our own experience of having economic growth as we've addressed some of these problems. So yes, I can imagine a lot of engagement from California at the national level as this is developed further.
So, Sean, in the end, could California's attitude on the Green New Deal be summed up like this? That's all really nice. We'll keep doing what we're doing. Call us if you need anything.
I suppose that's one way of looking at it. But I also think that the state really will and should welcome federal involvement, because there's a lot that the federal government can do that can't be done at the state level. And that's the promise of this type of legislation.
Sean Hecht is co-executive at the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA. Sean, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Staying with politics, 1 month ago today, Gavin Newsom succeeded Jerry Brown as California governor. Both are Bay Area Democrats from politically connected families. But in style and substance, Newsom is proving to be a very different governor than Brown, at least the second governor, Jerry Brown. Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler reports for our California Dream Project.
If you're doubting the start of a new era in California politics, just check out Gavin Newsom's January state budget presentation.
Unlike the previous administration, may spend a little bit more time on this than you want. So just warning you, full disclosure, this is something I really enjoy.
He then proceeded to talk about his budget for the next 2 hours. And while Jerry Brown would propose his spending plans in the state capitol's media room with low-tech poster boards.
I will mention our nice chart here. As you see,
Newsom invited a couple hundred people to an auditorium with PowerPoint slides.
They will punctuate some of the fundamental points we want to advance.
The substance of their proposals was very different, too, as Democratic Senate leader Tony Atkins noted at a recent Public Policy Institute of California event.
Jerry Brown proposed a budget, and he only wanted a few things. Gavin's thrown everything out there.
And that's a fundamental difference between the two men, says Dan Newman, a senior campaign aide to both governors. Brown, he says,
was more willing to let certain subjects wait for another day or another governor.
While Newsom
tends to swing at every pitch. He is genetically unable to say something is too hard or too politically fraught.
And so Newsom packed ideas from his campaign's 30 policy teams into his very first budget.
I know it's rote and cliche to say it's a reflection of our values, but it is a reflection of our values.
Well, Brown bristled at a question in our Capitol Public Radio exit interview last December when I asked him about issues he chose to avoid.
So the basis of your questioning is that I should be on every topic all the time. And that's not management. That's helter-skelter.
To Bill Whalen at Stanford's Hoover Institution.
They're about as different as their respective hairstyles.
Brown is 80 and bald. Newsom is 51 and has a full head of slicked back hair. Whalen says Newsom is more visibly energetic than Brown.
I'm not suggesting in the least that Jerry Brown sat in his office and did nothing but play Fortnite. He was a very busy governor, but doing a lot of things behind the scenes.
Newsom, on the other hand, has already held a bunch of public events around the state.
He enjoys being visible, and that's going to be his style.
They also speak very differently. Neither of them sound particularly like normal people. Brown, with his Latin proverbs.
Nemo Dot non habet.
And Newsom with what Whalen calls Bay Area cool speak.
Broad strokes around land use fiscalization, quite literally, not figuratively.
If you're looking for similarities, USC political analyst Sherry Bebich Jeffy says you might be better off comparing Newsom to Brown during his first governorship in the 1970s and 80s.
He's grasping as Jerry Brown 1.0 did, and Jerry Brown 2.0 did not do. He's grasping big issues. He has a very heavy, broad agenda.
Brown governed differently his second time around. He said he'd learned to be more focused. Newsom is well aware of that. And yet, as he said on the campaign trail last fall,
Jerry Brown was the right person at the right time. We're at a different time in our state's history, or a different time in our nation's history. And I think we're very well equipped to take the baton and build on that legacy.
And that, at least, is one character trait that both governors share: confidence. In Sacramento, I'm Ben Adler.
All right, now to a quick sports news roundup. The Lakers made a trade. No, not the one Larry Mantle and I were discussing on Air Talk earlier this week. The Lakers were not able to acquire Anthony Davis from the New Orleans Pelicans. He's that power forward who's averaging nearly 30 points per game. So, yeah, he's really, really good. But the Lakers did make a little history this morning when they went out and got a Clipper, Mike Muscala. It's the first trade between the Lakers and Clippers since they both became L.A. basketball teams 35 years ago. That's when the San Diego Clippers became the L.A. Clippers. Muscala, by the way, is averaging 7 points per game. And I know it's nowhere near Davis's 30 per game, but he is a pretty good three-point shooter, and the Lakers definitely need that. All right, now to baseball and some sad news. Hall of Fame baseball player and longtime L.A. resident Frank Robinson passed away today of bone cancer. He was 83. Robinson is best known for playing for the Reds and Orioles, but for one season in 1972, he played for the Dodgers, who then traded him to the Angels, who then traded him to the Indians, where he became the first African-American manager in Major League Baseball history. Here he is remembering after winning his first game.
And we wind up winning the game 5-3. Gaylord Perry's a pitch. He gives me the last ball of the winning baseball. And afterwards, everything. But I was kind of numb. It was a great moment, and a great moment in the history of baseball. And I thought about the comment that Jackie had mentioned about the wanting to be alive to see a African-American in the dugout over there.
And the Jackie he's speaking of course, is another L.A. son, Jackie Robinson, who passed away a few years earlier. He had been hoping he'd live to see an African-American running a team. Now, my first job ever was at the Robinson's department store in downtown L.A. That was back in the late 80s. I used to drive into the area all the time. Now, I don't drive into downtown as much anymore, but when I do, I'm always on the lookout for cyclists, you know, trying to be a considerate driver and all. But the thing is, the only really way to know what it's like to be a cyclist is to ride a mile in their pedals. I do that. I crashed. That's coming up next when Take Two continues in 60 seconds.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Ian Martinez.
No matter how... Sorry. Are you okay? Are you okay?
Yeah, I got it.
That was me a few weeks ago, biking through the streets of downtown L.A. Thankfully, I'm fine. That crash you heard happened when I was traveling in a bike lane trying to learn about the efforts to make Southern California more bicycle-friendly. But an unfriendly pedestrian was standing in the lane, blocking it. So I swerved around him and collided with my tour guide.
And that's part of the adventure of riding in downtown LA.
That's Eli Akira Kaufman, the new executive director of the LA County Bicycle Coalition.
You know, we're all just trying to get to where we're trying to go.
Yeah.
I met up with Kaufman because I wanted to know about his vision to convince more Californians to use two wheels. He says that can lead to less car traffic, nicer neighborhoods, and an improved quality of life. But Kaufman has a lot on his plate because it was clear that one of the biggest things to tackle is hoping that everyone shares the road.
There's a big SUV right in front of us in the bike lane, too. He shouldn't be there, right?
No, he shouldn't be.
Oh, man.
So once again...
So we had to go into traffic right now to go around him.
Absolutely, wow. And that's a common experience in downtown. And so I wouldn't say downtown I have a 10-year-old son, is a place that I would take him first until I felt like he was really comfortable on his bike.
There were times, though, that the infrastructure worked as planned to make a newer rider, like myself, feel good about biking.
That was a nice right turn. I actually felt pretty protected on that right turn.
Right. Now, so we just turned off of 11th onto
Figueroa,
right. And this is a relatively new bike infrastructure. You see the bus stop is actually protecting us from the traffic. The bike lane is painted green, so it's clearly demarked. And you have these bollards here that are meant to protect us. This infrastructure here is meant to really tell drivers that, hey, there is a different type of a transportation that's happening right next to you.
Eli, I gotta admit, this is the first time in our ride that I felt safe.
And it's great. There's signage up here. There's even a traffic light that has a bicycle. You see it's red up there. Now it just turned green. So now we've got the go-ahead to go. Drivers can see it. And it's more equitable. It's they're treating the cyclist as a member of the traffic community, right? Of the mobility community here. And that's what's so cool about this new level of infrastructure that's going in.
From there, we turned off of Figueroa, where bicyclists weren't as protected. I mean, I felt like it was Thunderdome at that point, everyone just commuting for themselves. As we pedaled, Kaufman says that he's going to work on changing the mindset of Southern Californians.
There's a dominant culture, right? And that dominant culture currently in LA is the car culture.
Yeah.
You know, people always call LA a car city, but it's pejorative, it's negative. I would love to get to the point where people are talking about LA as the greatest car city. Because of bike lanes and because of a more integrated infrastructure that serves all types of people and mitigates against traffic, lowers the number of cars that are on the road, gets more people outside and exercising on bicycles and by walking. I mean, I'd love it for us to have a t-shirt that says LA, the greatest car city on the planet, because we've got a thoughtful and inclusive and equitable streets for everybody. Ultimately, the goal is to make this a more friendly, safer and more equitable place for people just to be. LACBC is not about bikes, it's about people.
But for now, if you're thinking about trying to do more bicycling in LA, Kaufman has several ideas on how to get you hooked. First, do it with friends. And second, take advantage of one of the biggest bike paths in Southern California, one that's completely separated from cars.
The LA River Path, which is that continuous 51-mile path that runs from Canoga Park down to Long Beach. There's been a movement for a while to really build the amenities of that path so that it's properly lit. There's benches for people to sit down. There's better access points for folks to get on the path, to widen it, to pave it better. And so that would become like a transportation spine that would connect the city to itself. So that's a really exciting project. But in general, it's this infrastructure that we're seeing here, where it's just a more measured, more equitable street that allows cyclists, pedestrians, and cars to cohabitate.
That's Eli Akira Kaufman, the new executive director of the LA County Bicycle Coalition. Find out more about our ride and get some advice for first-time biking by heading to our website, take2.org. All right, staying on the streets, the rains create all kinds of issues for the city, and one of the most annoying is something you already see each and every single day driving around LA, potholes, which seem to have gotten worse.
Oh, 100%. I mean, on Del Mar, if you're heading east, there is a toddler-sized pothole.
Oh man, they've gotten so much worse since all the rain started. There's a really bad one on Olympic just east of La Brea that I think I've hit twice.
Every single day, I go to my local park a couple times, taking my dog out, and the entrance has this pothole that seems to be leading to China. Some people have dropped some sandbags in there, but they seem to have disintegrated, so I feel like I'm gonna lose a tire every time I go in there.
I drive on Colorado coming up from my house to work every day, and just before you cross the freeway overpass at San Rafael and Linda Vista, there's a pothole the size of a small VW. It's right in the middle of the road, so bicyclists won't hit it, but I have to avoid it, and the last time I was trying to go around it, the person next to me honked at me because I thought I went out of my lane, and it was either that or I was going to lose two tires in the pothole.
Recognize some of those voices. That was KPCC staffers Tamika Adams, Megan Larson, Sue Carpenter, and John Horn talking about some of their recent rain-induced pothole experiences. Now, to understand why potholes get worse in the rain and what the city plans to do about it, we have Greg Spotts. He's assistant director of the LA Bureau of Street Services. Greg, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
All right, the LA Department of Public Works tends to get a lot more calls reporting potholes whenever it rains. How many more calls has it gotten this week following the recent rainstorm?
We've been getting about 200 pothole service requests per day, which is about four times the number that we get in a non-storm period.
Okay. Now explain for us why the rain makes potholes so much worse.
Sure. When there's cracks or holes in the street and it rains, water gets in and disturbs the base. And now the riding surface can start to collapse a little bit.
Talking to Greg Spotts, he's assistant director of the LA Bureau of Street Services. All right, so what's the city's plan to fix the potholes that are reported?
So on a typical day, we would have 10 to 12 crews out there on a weekday fixing potholes. We've improved our ability to get to potholes quickly through digitizing the process. Our inspections of the potholes are now done on tablets, which provides us instant information from the field that we can use to dispatch a truck to that location.
So when could possibly most of them or as many as possible be fixed?
We have a goal of completing street pothole requests within 2 to 3 working days from when they're called in.
How much does it cost to fix an average pothole?
It can cost something like, you know, $40 to fix a small pothole. They can be very wide variety of sizes, and it depends.
Yeah, people get impatient, though, Greg. So, I mean, it's been a week since the really hard rain fell. Still a lot of potholes out there. I'm wondering, are people just not reporting them necessarily, or is it just hard to fill them all right now?
We're getting more reports than we've ever gotten because it's easy to report a pothole using the smartphone app called MyLA311.
Now, you mentioned the way people can report a pothole. How do people do it? Is it just simply just describing the pothole, or do they just need to say, hey, there's a hole in the street here, come get it?
I feel the easiest way to report the pothole is using the MyLA311 smartphone app because it can drop a pin on your current location without even having to enter an address.
Oh, so that's all they got to do. They got to just use the app and not much else.
You can get to the point where you can do it in less than 2 minutes.
All right, that's Greg Spotts, Assistant Director of the Los Angeles Bureau of Street Services. Greg, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
And if you want to report a pothole the old-fashioned way, you can call City Services at 311. If you use public transportation or want to use it more, you might find this of interest. The Los Angeles County Metropolitan Transportation Authority has announced a partnership with a company called GetAround. GetAround connects people who want to rent their car in town with people who are interested in renting out their own vehicles for a period of time. It's called peer-to-peer car rental or car sharing. Here's Nadine Lee, interim chief of staff for LA Metro, talking about how GetAround can improve people's access to public transportation.
This is a huge and exciting opportunity for our riders. You know, I talk to a lot of people about, you know, how we complete people's trip. So the first last mile is such a huge problem for people because sometimes things are just a little too far away, or maybe you have to carry too many things on your journey. And so it's not so convenient to just walk or take a bike.
Get Around will use spaces at Metro stations in the San Fernando Valley, San Gabriel Valley, South Bay, South LA, and the West Side. Prices will begin at $5 per hour depending on the vehicle type.
Round, round, get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round, I get around,
I get around.
Getting a green card is a big moment for immigrants to the U.S. It's when they become legal permanent residents here, and there's a path to citizenship. I mean, it's a big deal. I've seen it with my own eyes how happy people get. But there's a decision looming that could mean fewer people will be able to get a green card, and that has led to people making a personal decision that could affect their health. Find out what it is when Take Two continues.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering 3 psychology master's degrees during the summer term. Convenient locations for working professionals in West LA, Encino, and Irvine. Graduates in psychology, marriage and family therapy, and behavioral psychology are prepared to pursue licensure or a doctorate in their designated field. Classes start in April. Apply by February 15th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. The Trump administration is on the verge of approving an update to its immigration policy known as the Public Charge Rule. If it does happen, then immigrants could be less likely to get a green card. But the proposed rule is complicated, and there have been several different versions floating around since last year. All that has scared immigrants into thinking they need to drop their health care coverage. KPCC's Alyssa Jung Perry reports.
The latest version of the proposed public charge would prevent immigrants from getting a green card if they use some form of non-cash federal government assistance like Medi-Cal. 61-year-old Dennis Beck has been trying to figure out what the rule would mean for him. I met with Beck, who's in the country illegally, at a community clinic in LA's Koreatown. He has high cholesterol, so he needs to go to the doctor every 3 months to get medication. Like most immigrants who don't use English as their first language, Beck relies on news in his native tongue, Korean. I searched the internet for the public charge, he says. I read every single article from the local Korean newspapers to get more information about the rule. Beck says he wanted a green card ever since he came to America almost 20 years ago. But what he's reading in the news is scaring him. My understanding is that if I get government help, then I can't get a green card, Beck says. My wife thinks we should stop getting help. We should end it right away. But actually, he doesn't need to end his health coverage. That's because he's enrolled in MyHealthLA, the county's free health care program for unauthorized immigrants. Again, the latest version of the public charge proposal would only penalize green card applicants who receive non-cash federal benefits like Medi-Cal. So,
what if I told him it probably is not going to affect him?
No, I didn't know that, he says. I was sure that getting any government help, federal, county, or whatever, would create a problem when I tried to get a green card. I assumed it was all bad. But Beck isn't the only one worried about how the rule might affect his health care. Courtney Powers is with the Community Clinic Association of LA County. It represents 65 health centers throughout the region. She says clinics are reporting an increased number of calls about the proposal.
Media reports and other information in the community that may be misleading or inaccurate as to who the rule affects and how it could affect them. So many of our clinics reporting patients not wanting to access healthcare services because of the fear and the anxiety.
So the Koreatown clinic that Beck goes to, CARE, works actively with LA's Korean media outlets to make sure they're publishing the most up-to-date and accurate stories about the public charge. Jaehee Lee, who works at CARE, says a lot of confusion around the public charge is because an earlier draft said that immigrants could be flagged for deportation or denied a green card if their U.S.-born child used any public benefits.
I review all the articles and point out the misinformation and try to correct them or give correct information.
So she sends out press releases and informational packets to local Korean reporters. One reason for inaccurate reporting could be that foreign language and ethnic media outlets are small. Kelly McBride is a media ethicist.
You know, if you're reporting the story about this national policy, the liability is you don't have a reporter in Washington at the agency that's making the policy, right? You're relying on other sources of information because they don't have the resources.
However, Bride says these smaller news outlets do have an advantage.
What you do have are a staff that lives in the neighborhood and shops at the same grocery stores and talks to the audience. And so you have the asset is the ability to hear what the questions are and listen more closely.
Dennis Beck, who thought he would have to drop out of My Health LA, is relieved to learn that he doesn't need to. It's not an issue that all Americans are going through. It's specific to immigrants. So the media outlets need to explain more clearly about the programs, Beck says. Then I wouldn't have to worry so much. Covering health, I'm Alyssa Jung Perry.
All right, moving on. Military training is going along as planned, but the Army has fallen short when it comes to hitting the Trump administration's ambitious new recruiting goals. To increase interest in military service among teenagers, the Army is reaching out to some of the people who know them best, high school teachers and guidance counselors. Reporter Dan Boyce has the story.
All right, you guys, welcome to Fort Carson. I'm Sergeant First Class Stone. I'm the USAR.
About 20 people from Colorado high schools are huddled in a group at the sprawling Army base just outside Colorado Springs. Teachers, counselors, administrators. It's cold, it's windy, and it is snowing.
You guys just so happen to pick the best day of the year to come.
They are nevertheless forging ahead with this day-long tour of the base, led around a fleet of military vehicles, troop carriers and the like, some weighing 30-plus tons. The educators climb in and out of the various rigs, supervised by soldiers in their full battle garb. Army Captain and recruiter Wes Barber says recruiting strategy used to be focused on the bravery and the thrill inherent in military life.
That bravado that you're talking about, there are still folks out there that want that. There are still folks out there that just want to serve their country.
Yet Barber says to reach the Trump administration's higher recruitment goals, the Army has to appeal to more than a young person's sense of adventure. He's hoping to show these teachers the military is a smart, professional, and academic choice for career-minded kids.
I would conjecture that when you join the military, you are in fact choosing college.
That's Larry Beer. He's an education services specialist with the Army. The teachers are listening to Beer speak in a large gymnasium, an enormous American flag taking up much of the wall behind them. Beer says the Army can be part of a serious collegiate plan right from the start, explaining recruits can earn college credit through their training process, even in basic training. There are more than 150 career options in the Army.
Those represent IT, they represent medical fields, HR, logistics. Anyone heard of Amazon?
The Army is pushing this more academically-minded approach in tours like this, and also in broad new efforts online, through social media, fielding teams in video game tournaments, and more. David Armstrong is an English teacher at Los Animas High School. He says the tour is broadening his perspective of what the Army can provide.
Their job is not just to carry a gun and a 50-pound backpack and go shoot people. You know, it's to, in some cases, be an operating room specialist.
All the teachers here have volunteered to come on this tour, and everyone I speak with is coming away with a positive impression of the options in the Army. The teachers are also having some fun while they're at it. They move on to a series of semi-trailers posted side-by-side in a parking lot. Inside, several stations, imitating the driver's seats of some of those vehicles the teachers were shown earlier. The windshields are replaced by flat-screen televisions, and the teachers take part in an elaborate simulation of a video game, really. Kate Bridgman is taking her turn behind the wheel.
I'm the English language development teacher at Cheyenne Mountain High School.
Many of her students are green card holders, considering the military as a path to citizenship. She's never been on Fort Carson. After living and working near it for years, she's glad she's getting a more thorough understanding of it.
As an educator, I need to look at all avenues for my kids, what they're ready for, what they're looking for, and that the military has certainly developed a much more diverse kind of approach.
While Bridgman's here, she's not above taking her own diverse approach to driving the simulator, going as fast as she can and crashing her virtual truck. Which, incidentally, crashes the whole system, necessitating a hard reboot.
Go ahead and get in the prone firing position.
The tour ends with a visit to a virtual firing range. Sergeant Chris England has the teachers lay down with their imitation AR-15s.
Okay. Everybody's ready to go.
While the Army might be more than just shooting a gun is definitely still part of it. In Colorado Springs, I'm Dan Boyce.
This story was reported as part of the American Homefront Project, covering military life and veterans' issues. KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, Your Survival Guide, is sweeping the nation. As the title said, it's all about what life could be like right after a big earthquake and how you can survive it all. Now, while it's jam-packed with crucial information, people still have questions. Now, luckily, the host of the podcast will be here with all the answers. Get ready to write them all down when Take 2 continues in 60 seconds. Back now with Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. As anyone who lives in Los Angeles already knows, a potentially devastating earthquake is overdue along the San Andreas Fault. KPCC's got a new podcast to help you prepare. It's called The Big One, Your Survival Guide. Now, 5 episodes have already aired, and it turns out a lot of you still have a lot of questions about what you've heard. So we thought we'd bring in science reporter Jacob Margolis to help answer them. He's the host of The Big One podcast. Hello, Jacob.
Hey.
All right. A lot of people have been asking about supplies. I think that's probably the number one question everyone has. So what should people have on hand in case of an earthquake?
Okay. The first thing is I frame all preparation for this big quake in my mind like this. I want to be comfortable and want my family to be comfortable for 2 to 3 weeks without having to rely on other people's help.
Wow, it's a long time.
It's a long time, but it's a personal stretch goal. I am definitely not there. So what does that mean? Think about what you need first off day to day, right? I have a wife, I have a son, and there's myself. So I need 1 gallon per person per day of water. That's per FEMA. That's 63 gallons. I've bought a bunch of the 1 gallon jugs. I've been sticking them in my garage. It's not the cheapest, it's not the most efficient way, but we can rotate that water out. We can use it over time.
Yeah.
We couldn't really afford a large cistern of water, but that's an option, especially if you can keep some water treatment stuff in the garage with you.
I want to ask, though, your son is like barely a year old. Does the gallon still count for a baby?
I'm still keeping it.
You're still? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm still doing that. So in addition to the water, we also need to have food. That means cans of beans. You know, we have some sauce for flavor, some rice, spices, place to the side. And really, if I could spring for it, I would go with freeze-dried food because that seems to do better, store for a bit longer, but it's a little too expensive. All of the stuff that I mentioned is also pretty stable. You also need some extra medicine if you take medicine. And then we have the non-perishable stuff. So we have a tent, we have sleeping bags, pads, stuff that if our house is uninhabitable, we can sleep outside for a bit. I would love a generator, but again, they're expensive.
Yeah.
And we're lucky that we have a backyard to stay in and like family houses nearby. And that's the last thing. Make sure you talk to family members or friends. See if you can have an alternative kind of emergency plan, a place to go if your place isn't habitable.
Okay, now that's all great, but a lot of people, Jacob, live in apartments or don't have garages. So I would imagine storing all that stuff you just mentioned is difficult. So what do you recommend they do?
Big problem, right? Maggie reached out to us via Harkin and asked where the best place to store 30 gallons of water is. And I'd say the place with the least extreme temperature fluctuation. So our garage is insulated, doesn't really go above 90 degrees, which is pretty good for the valley. If you don't have the room, you just need to store as much water as you can in as many places as you can. If you can even have a week's worth of water for your family, like you're going to be better off than most. And remember that emergency water and food stations will be set up across Southern California within maybe the first couple days, maybe the first week. However, what I want to avoid is having to wait in line for all those supplies. And that's why I chose 3 weeks, because I really hate standing in lines. And if I'm already worried about this big disaster, I want to be as comfortable as possible.
Right. Now, someone also asked how much cash they should have on hand and if they should have a landline or cell phone.
So for the cash, I would say figure out how much you need for a week of survival. So maybe for a family of three, I don't know, $500. But you're not going to be buying all the usual stuff that you buy. I'm just thinking about stuff for supplies, groceries, maybe
basic
water.
Basic stuff, right?
Basic stuff. If you can have that in a safe place that you know is not going to get stolen, it's always a good thing to have. It's not like you're throwing the cash away. You could also use it on a rainy day, right?
Yeah.
Regarding the phone line, I have a landline. I think that's advisable if possible. Cell networks could go down. The internet could be out. And if you have a landline, you can oftentimes make calls in disasters. That said, a lot of landlines are now voice over IP, and so they're connected to the internet. And so if the internet's down, that line's not going to work. We have a hard line in our house.
I got to check.
It's so old.
I got to check. I know I used to have one, and it wasn't that long ago that I had one, but I can't say for sure that I still have one up and running.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing to have if you have the option, although they also get kind of expensive. And that's what we have to say about all this. All of this is kind of expensive prepping for this stuff. So what my family and I have prioritized is just doing little bit by little bit over a long period of time with the hope that eventually we will feel prepared and ready.
All right, another question came from a woman named Norma who asked about a car emergency kit. And specifically, she wanted to know what food and water was best to keep in a place that gets hot.
Yeah, so I have canned water in my car. You know, that's supposedly okay in temperatures up to 130 degrees. I've always had a couple of gallons of water and plastic jugs in my car, too. People are worried about the plastic leaching into the water, and so that's why people are asking. You know, in an emergency situation, is that what you're going to be worried about? Is kind of what I have to ask myself and ask other people. Probably not if I'm just worried about dehydrating to death. In regards to food, some bars would be great. Maybe dried fruit. Make sure there's no chocolate in it, because then it gets everywhere. It's really messy. And I store all this stuff along with some extra clothes and other things, emergency supplies for the car, in a bag in my wheel well, because there's a little compartment there. And that doesn't get quite as hot as the rest of the car.
One of the things I think I told you last time we spoke was that from the Northridge earthquake, I realized that I didn't never had shoes or sandals under my bed. That's why I cut my feet on the glass that was on the ground.
Yeah.
Ever since then, no matter where I'm sleeping in L.A., I have shoes or sandals below my bed. But one of the things I think that a lot of people don't think of, Jacob, underwear and socks to last you a while, because I think jeans you could wear for weeks, even if they get dirty, you can still deal with them. But socks and underwear, I think it's a matter of hygiene for me.
I have extra clothes in my car emergency
kit. You do?
Okay. I have extra clothes in our garage stored in there just because we might not be able to do any laundry.
Yeah.
If that's a big concern for you, if you want to wear two new fresh pairs of socks a day, two new pairs of underwear a day, maybe you should go out to Costco or a big box store, Walmart, and buy a bunch of that and stick it to the side so that you know you're going to be okay for, say, 2 to 3 weeks.
All right, now there's a new episode of the podcast out today, and it's called The Economy, and I can guess what that's about.
Yeah, it's about the economy.
There you
when
go.
When we started the series, we had this idea that Southern California, you know, gets hit by a quake, the economy is going to collapse, maybe the rest of the U.S. would fall into recession. Turns out not to be the case. That said, on a personal level, we did find that even if you have insurance, you might not be okay. Even if you are able to try to get some money from the government for help, that might be really difficult. And that if you're a person of color, you're a lot worse off when it comes to recovery. And we dive deep into all this week, so you should give it a listen.
All right, Jacob Margolis is KPCC science reporter and host of The Big One, Your Survival Guide. There are new episodes every single Thursday, and if you got questions on how to prepare for The Big One, you can tweet Jacob. He's at Jacob Margolis. Jacob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Shake. 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 Listen. Listen while I talk to you.
Finally today, the campus of Cal State Long Beach is mining for some ideas, and it's possible you can help out. Last fall, the college moved to scrap its longtime mascot, Prospector Pete. Some said Pete harkened back to a time when prospectors swarmed the state, displacing and harming the indigenous people who were in their way. But the student government announced that starting on Monday, it will take new mascot ideas. Now, to make a suggestion, you can be a student, faculty, staff member, or even someone who's just passionate about the school. After about a month, the final mascot nominations will be decided and voted on by students. The winner will be presented to the administration, who gets the final say. Come next spring, Cal State Long Beach will debut its brand new mascot. All right, so what's your idea? How about the beach or maybe the dirt bags? Those are actually the names of some of the athletic teams already at the school. But perhaps you think the college should come up with a single mascot for all of them. Tell us what you think. Give us some suggestions by heading to our Twitter at Take Two. And while you're there at Take Two, why don't you follow me as well? Take Two follows me. You should follow me too. At A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2:00.